Hey everyone, this is Jan-Niklas and welcome to the Weekly Staff Brew. Today, I'm sitting down with Mark Thompson, a tech educator who's managed to do some may dream about, but few achieve, bridging the gap between teaching code and actually shipping it. From university lecture halls to the Angular team, Mark has spent over a decade showing us that the best engineers aren't just the ones who build, but the ones who can explain what they build the way they did. So grab your favorite morning beverage and get comfortable, and let's explore what happens when passion for education meets technical excellence. This conversation might just change how you approach your next project or your entire career. Hey, Mark, how's it going today?
Okay, first off, that introduction, though, right? Like, that was so good. That was so good. Oh, my gosh, that's amazing.
Thank
you. Good writing, good presentation. That was excellent. Yeah. I'm feeling good. I'm just really like impressed by you right now. Like, I knew you were cool, but that was excellent.
I appreciate that a lot. So, Mark, you've balanced being both an educator and an engineer throughout your career. Like, what helps you maintain that creative spark in a way?
Sure. So one of the things, I'll be completely honest, that I feel is missing from most tech education is being in service of the learner. Meaning, yes. Like, when I think about things, like, I'm never thinking about, like, okay, for example, here's why I was super successful in at university teaching, because a lot of professors and instructors and lecturers were like, I'm going to demonstrate just how smart I am. And for me, it was like, I don't even care if you think I'm smart. And sometimes I would get students who would, like, they couldn't believe that what I was saying was, like, right, because I would break it down in such a way that anyone could understand it and they wouldn't believe it. And then sometimes I'd have TAs come up and try to re-explain what I just said, because they're like, no, it has to be more complex than this. But I would always think about, what is the way that I can say this so that you feel like you are the smartest person in the room after hearing it, right? That you feel super confident, you feel super empowered. And so for me, that's what's always made teaching so interesting, and how to be creative, because I'm always thinking, like, okay, this is really hard to understand. There has to be a way for me to make it available to everybody.
I love that. And one thing that you said really resonates with me, because you see that a lot in, like, tech presentation where people start, this is my talk title, and let me start by, like, talking 5 minutes about myself to show you how great I am. Like, I get it, and to some extent that it's important to show you know your stuff, but, like, this is not about you. This is at no point about you. This is always about the people in the audience.
That's right. And here's what's really interesting about that. Like, if you, because that's such a, like, astounding and astute, like, idea. It's not about you. It's about the people in the audience. Even if you're talking about yourself, it's technically still about the people in the audience, right? Like, I gave a keynote for that conference in 2024, and it was, like, a part of my, like, personal health journey, right? And just, like, what matters to me and how I use my core values. It was still me telling my story to inspire you as the learner or as the listener to make the choices that I think will help you live a really meaningful and profound life.
I think there are two very different ways how you can tackle those kind of things. It's either like, oh, look at me, how great I am, or, hey, I have some experience that is really relevant to what you are dealing with.
Yep.
Let me show you how I manage it. Maybe it helps you. I love that.
Yes, 100%, 100%.
So, Mark, if you could go back and give yourself one piece of coding advice, right? Coding advice. Like, thinking back of your first days as a developer, like, if I think back without beard and, like, looking like a puppy, what would you tell yourself looking
back? Yeah, so I've been working professionally for almost 20 years. So I got my first job as an engineer in 2006. I started writing code when I was 15. Maybe a little bit younger than that, maybe 14, but I got my first job in 2006. So, 2025 now. So 20 years of time, I've learned a lot of things.
Yeah.
And the thing that I would tell myself back then was probably, like, don't be afraid, because it's already broken. Right. Like, so let's say that I'm trying to fix a bug, or I'm trying to, like, add a new feature. It already doesn't work. So don't be afraid to, like, explore the solution and to just try things. Because I feel like I spent a lot of time in my career with, like, a little bit of analysis paralysis, where I'm, like, so afraid of making a mistake because I'm like thinking about, okay, what's the code review going to look like, right? What are they going to say about how good or bad my code is? What are the tests? You know what I mean? Like, I'm thinking about all these like kind of like negative outcomes, but I'm like, nothing even works right now. So why am I so worked up about it? And if it doesn't work now, that's literally why you are hired, is to figure it out. And if you can't figure it out, guess what? You have a team. You can get help. So I think just getting rid of that fear and being able to just like go forward, I think that's one of the main things I would say. And if I had to add one tiny little caveat on there, one extra thing, I would say explore solutions more thoroughly. I think that sometimes as like engineers, especially in the young days, we like see like an API. We're like, okay, this one's going to work, right? But I think you could do a little bit more thinking and practice that, right? Like, you have to practice this because you only get it through experience, but do a little bit more thinking about like, what options are available to me? What makes the most sense? Is this a short-term versus a long-term solution? You know what I mean? Like, just think more broadly and not so narrow into the, like, I just got to get this bug fixed. Okay. Right. Like, think more broadly, because then you'll come up with more robust solutions over time.
I think particularly that skill is also getting more important now over the years with like the embrace of AI. Like, let's be real. All coders are going to use AI in one way or another in the next couple of years. But like, I think where it's going to be like the important distinguishment is like, okay, either you have those people that just use it and be like, accept. This all looks great. Or the people that accept it, but resonate with like, okay, what did just happen? Does it work? Does it do the things I wanted to do? Why does it do it? Like, and this way, like, actively, like, encourage a learning process. I think that's going to be like a key differentiator between like the, and I don't mean this in a negative way, but the average developer and the ones that are going to excel and utilize AI in the proper way. How do you see
it? I think that the whole AI story is so interesting. And it's interesting because I think developers are in like a couple of different buckets, maybe two or three buckets right now. I think there are people who are like wholesale, like rejecting AI. They're like, no AI for me. I'm just, it's not as smart as I am. Right. So therefore, yeah, I don't even care about it. Then I think there are people who are just like, AI is the best thing ever. Then I'm not even going to think about the code that I write or author anymore that I participate in. And then there's somebody where I think you should be in the middle, which is, what can AI do for me that is going to help me like improve things? And so I think it's dangerous to be on the extremes of anything, right? Like, I think people who say AI slop or AI is garbage, I think that's just short-sighted, right? Because I think as an engineer, here's the thing where I love to use AI. If I already know what to do, that is my value add, right? On a keyboard. Like, I know what needs to be done. So here's what I know. I know that I'm building a distributed system, right? And I know that I need caching here, and I know that I need load balancing. I know, you see what I'm saying? I know what to do. So then getting an AI assistant to help me smooth out that process means what? Less time just churning through things that are, is that the best use of my time, right? And so, exactly. So that's what I think about. It's like, how can I use AI to do the things that could like help me to be more productive and then get more done, but not at the sake of like, okay, I'm just going to generate my entire app and then like I'm just going to let AI do the whole thing. I don't think that's the full story.
Yeah.
I think that we will have new systems involved. There's a whole lot to this story. And I think that AI is a powerful tool. I think it's a mistake to say that it is a fad. I think that is incorrect.
Yeah.
But I do think there are some patterns maybe that are fads, right? Like, We'll get past some of those things. But I think AI as a tool to help us make better products is here to stay.
I like to compare it. So one of my professors in university forced us to use Notepad so that we basically just had like a basic text editor, because like all the fancy IDE features make it hard to actually learn stuff. And no one would approach this topic anymore like this. Like, it's just an outdated way of thinking about things. And I think in a similar way, AI is going to be a tool we utilize to be more effective at what we do on an average, on a daily basis.
100%. And that's a really interesting thing, because when I interviewed at Google, I had to use like a Google Doc to like do my whiteboarding interview, because I interviewed during COVID. So it was like a Google Doc, no IDE.
Oh,
right. Yeah. Because you know what they cared about? I think and this is me talking as the interview person, the person being interviewed, sorry, and not the interviewer, so I can't speak on Google's behalf, but I feel like they care more about, did I know what to do, versus did I know every single syntactical like line, right? Like it didn't really matter because guess what's going to be able to happen? I'm going to be able to like Stack Overflow search. I'm going to be able to Google search. Now I'm going to be able to AI, like, you know, like pair program with an AI. Like, hey, I'm trying to do this. What's a good way to do that? You know, like, cause here's what, again, I keep going back to this idea. Me knowing what to do is what makes me special. What makes you special? Cause you know what to do from all your experience. Right. So.
Okay. Now I'm curious because I never worked for like a FANG level company. How did you perceive the interview process at Google? I know some parts are probably going to be NDA related. But how is that? How did you prepare? Like, what would you recommend people that might want?
Oh, yeah. So if you want to get into like one of the FANG companies or mangas, another way they say it now, since Facebook is now Meta, fine, right? Like, that's fine. Call yourself whatever you want. It's not my company. I think what's really interesting is how much tolerance do you have for just discipline, right? And because that's what you really need is like discipline, because you need to spend a lot of time prepping for the interview process. I probably spent 3 months, probably like 1 to 2 hours a night, like studying, right? And that was just an exercise in discipline, just because it's really easy to be like, yeah, you know, I don't want to spend that time. Okay, you don't have to, right? Because there are lots of jobs that don't require such a rigorous prep. But I like, you know, read Cracking and Coding Interview. I use like algorithm apps to like challenge myself. I timed myself, right? Because that was one of the things that was a little harder for me, is that like I could always arrive at the right answer, but could I arrive at the right answer with enough time in the interview? Right. So that was just a thing that I really worked on, was like, okay, I need to be able to solve my first version of the solution within like 10 minutes, right? Maybe 15 at the most, but like I kind of have to be able to like get there. You give me the problem, I need to get my first solution. So I think if you want to do it, if you want to work at a company where they have those style of like, you know, programming challenges, I think the biggest thing you can do is one, learn about algorithms and data structures, because what it always comes down to is being able to look at a problem and identify which algorithm or data structure makes this problem a like easy breezy problem, right? Because there's like certain keywords, certain patterns you learn, like, oh, this is a tree. If it's a tree, oh, I probably need recursion. You see what I'm saying? So like, boom, I got my data structure, got my algorithm. Now it's just the idea of, now that I know what my tools are, what do I need to use, or like, how do I use those tools to actually solve the problem now?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I have to ask this question because like looking from a perspective, or like from a person that doesn't like doing things like that, quite honest, do you think it helps you now in the job you have at Google?
Yes.
Or is this more like a stepping stone or like a barrier that you have to?
No, I think that people who say, oh, you know, I'm in day 3000 of my technical career and I still don't need data structures and algorithms. And I would argue that maybe there's a place for them to be when you hit enough scale. So at Google, we're not talking about 1,000 users concurrently.
No.
We're talking about millions of concurrent users on apps. That's a very different problem, right? So like, so think about the same algorithm. So think about like, if you have to do 1,000 database reads versus 10 million database reads per like minute, those two things, you can get away with the for loop, you know what I'm saying? Or some like regular loop structure at 1,000. At 10 million, you got to start like partitioning and doing, you got to start doing all kinds of like things. So it makes a difference depending on the type of work that you do. Now, if you're working on an internal like SaaS app for your, you know, you work in an insurance company's internal portal, of course, you're probably not going to run into the need of a like a red and black tree or something, right? You don't really care about that. But here is the place where I thought it was super interesting. When I was preparing for my interview, I remember I had to like use, but one of the problems was like a scoreboard, right? Like the leaderboard, you know, where people, you know, they give you like a data set of scores. You got to like, you know, be able to put them on the screen and do some sorting. But when I did it with the for loop, it would run out of time at scale. Then I had to like use, I think I had to use like a binary search or something like that to like sort, or binary sort to sort it. You see, so it's like when you look at scale, that's when those algorithms and data structures make sense. And so it's okay if you work at a job where that just doesn't happen for you. And that's okay. Like, I think there are lots and lots of jobs where that doesn't matter as much. But I think when you start to work at bigger companies where they have, and even if it's not even a big company, if you work at a company that works at a large scale, that's where it really matters.
Yeah. I also noticed, so I did for some interviews, like use that too to prep. And to some extent, it's also fun. Like if you don't like the time pressure, like I have an interview, if you exclude those parts from the equation, right? But if you just like, I mean, most of us engineers like solving problems, and that's like peak problem solving. It's like, okay, here's a problem. Give me an easy solution. And then there are like different degrees, like you said, like, usually when I did it, like I found the easy solution within like a couple of minutes, and then you hit into like the test cases of like, okay, what happens if this function is executed a million times in a second and those tests fail? And then you're like, well, maybe I should look at some algorithms for this. So I also to some extent enjoy that challenge, but I'm also like very triggered by challenge. So that's another new thing.
It can be fun, but I think you're right when you say when it's not, you know, within the time pressure of like, I got to get this, my interviews in 2 weeks or 3 weeks or whatever. And last thing I'll say about like prepping for a big tech interview, give yourself some time. Like if you're thinking about applying at Google, Microsoft, Amazon, Meta, Netflix, or any of these like big companies, start prepping now. Even if you're thinking about it, start by doing a problem a day, right? Just like give yourself some time. I think me having 3 months to prepare helped. Because I was like, okay, I'm not like trying to cram. I was like just giving myself time to refresh a lot of the things that I had learned in university.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. On that note, though, we talked a lot about like technical aspects of the interview. Do you think there's a non-technical skill in our industry or like that is very important for our industry?
I think leadership is very important. And I think leadership... Like, so there's this term from this book called 360 degree leader. And a 360 degree leader is someone who knows how to lead up, meaning like you can lead your leaders, lead down anybody that you're managing or like in a team lead for, you can lead them, but you can also lead laterally, like your peers and such, and have influence that way. I think just knowing how to lead in that way is super important because eventually you need to have influence over people. So let's consider this idea. You and I are on the same team. We're the same level, both software, senior software engineers. Let's say that.
Right.
I need you to do something, right? Like I need you to prioritize some work that I think is really important that I've heard from my, you know, person, my manager, like this is really important. I need you to do it. How do I get you to do that? How do I communicate with you? How do I convince you and then the people who are prioritizing your work to let you work on it, but then also get you to have buy-in on that? Right. Like, I think that is such a underrated skill because what ends up happening usually when people don't necessarily align, they stonewall and then they have arguments and it becomes a conflict. But that's not helpful to anybody. No. So how do I avoid the conflict by communicating and leading?
And the thing that I think is difficult with those kind of situations is like, there's no particular framework for like working with people in that sense. Like there are like schemes and stuff, but like. Like you will motivate me very differently than I would motivate you. And we're both like grew up in a Western society and those things. That's entirely different if you work with like other cultures and stuff. So that's just the thing that is always mind boggling to me when I talk to managers. And like I had one manager that was like super into like psychology and stuff. And it was super interesting to see how he interacts completely different with different people. But it's a skill at the end of the day. And you need to know that. The thing that I think is the most important, and I would probably tell my younger self, and people that know me know that too, I'm a big fan of transparency. So I think I look at you in a different light in a job interview if you straight away tell me, I don't know the answer to this, versus mingling your way around, being like, okay, like there is place for like sharing your thoughts about things, but there's also like a way to say, I have no idea, but I would know how to find answer to this. And I did a lot of consulting before, so I think transparency is just so underrated. I interacted with so many consulting companies that were like, oh yeah, no, we cannot share the progress status on that because we're behind the timeline. So they're like bullshitting around with the client instead of just straight away saying, we are delayed. This is how much time we need. It's in the end better for everyone. So yes, it might be uncomfortable, but transparency, I've never regretted being transparent afterwards.
So I hear a little known fact. During my interview, I actually had to say that. And I thought that it was over. Yeah, I thought it was over. I thought I blew it.
I did, particularly as a consultant, I did a lot of interviews. And the minute I notice you don't know the answer, but don't tell me, it's over for me. Like, I will let you fail over this. Because it's just a lack of trust that I have in you as a person of like being transparent. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was really transparent. I was like, you know what? I'm stuck. This problem is a good problem. And I know that with more time and less, maybe it's the pressure. And I was just very transparent. I was like, maybe it's the pressure of the situation, but I'm stuck. And I know that, you know, you've been trying to like give me hints and push me in the right direction, but I just can't see the solution. And I'm just like, I'm at a brick wall and I understand we're out of time. And I just said that I was completely honest. And I thought that I had like blown the Google interview. I was like, yeah, it's over. You know, I went outside, you know, cause I was in my office and I walked out and I had tears in my eyes because I had been studying for months and this is the big day. And then I was like, oh, I didn't perform. You know what I mean? Like I couldn't get past this problem. And, I think that honestly was a benefit to me because then I talked about in my next, cause I had to do 5 1-hour interviews. And then in the next one, I talked about what I learned from that experience. I was just very honest. I was like, listen, here's what I learned. I learned what it's like to be in a like boxing match or, you know, like a fist fight match where you get knocked down and then they expect you to get back up and keep fighting. But what's in the back of your mind the whole time is you don't want to get knocked down again. And so what does that create in your body? Creates all this anxiety and all this like fear. And I was like, that's what I feel right now because I did not get the right answer. So now this all, I said, but listen, I'm going to do my best, but I understand now why when somebody gets knocked down in a boxing match, why it's so hard to keep fighting because you're so afraid of getting knocked down again because you don't want that to happen.
That's super interesting. And what a coincidence. Mm-hmm. Love that. So besides all like technical stuff, you've also worked across tech stacks for decades. Like Angular wasn't around 2005 as far as I know. So what is something in like modern development that still feels like magic to you? I have a couple ideas for myself where I'm just like, okay, I'm just accepting the answer here. I have no idea.
Oh, sure. I think the browser is magic. Web browsers are amazing. Like I remember I wrote my own web browser way back in 2002 as a college homework assignment, right? Like nothing, like I'm a genius. But I was like, oh, this is like, it was like basic. You know what I mean? Like I had my web browser, you could make the request, blah, blah, blah. We would display the page, but I didn't even have to work on the rendering engine. And I was like, man, so this little browser is pretty powerful. And then I can go online later, you know, use PHP and I could like, or Perl, and I could like make these scripts and I could do these things. And now you can write code in the browser and compile in the browser, right? Like you can watch videos, you can do all this stuff.
Every time I see the announcement from like the Chrome DevTools team, oh, these are the new fancy things we do. And I'm like, that's super cool. I have no idea how you would even tackle that, but that's pretty
cool. Isn't that amazing? Like, think about this. A couple of years ago at Google I.O., we talked about how Chrome and Adobe had, I think they had worked together, something like that. There was some type of interaction with Adobe, but like they had a version of Photoshop that ran in the browser. And I was like, I remember when Photoshop could barely run on your PC. Right? Because of how much resources it needs. And now we can have Photoshop, we can have image editing, video editing in the browser. Like we're using a web platform to record together right now. Like think about how bananas that is, right? The browser is just amazing technology. I would have never envisioned that we'd be here 20 years ago.
Yeah. And when I started my career, I worked at like a little Rails shop and like everyone was like super anti JavaScript. And we're like, it's not secure. It's slow. The language is not great. And to be fair, Ruby is a pretty cool language. So comparatively, like JavaScript is not a great language, but, so I kind of grow into the sentiment of like, okay, the browser is kind of like lacking and we're using a server to like accommodate for that. And by now, every time I'm like, no, the browser is not
right.
A problem.
That's right. My skill, it's a skill issue now.
Yeah, I'm not saying that in an interview though. But
I was saying for me, I'm like, when I can't do something, I'm like, no, this is a skill issue. Like, I need to work on it or something. It's so funny.
That's funny. I feel like every time when I talk to Ryan about like signals or something, I'm like, I know all the words you're saying, and like I can put them in the same sentence, but I have no idea what you're saying. Can you put that in like small, comprehensible chunks?
Computer science is so interesting like that. So if we go beyond like just regular programming, right? Like of just like type, you know, pecking keys, you know, with their fingers. It's like computer science is just such a fascinating field that we're still finding, you know, patterns and concepts, and we're still like exploring and like creating new ideas. It's just so fascinating. So I went to, I have a bachelor's degree and a master's degree. And so in university, for my master's degree, one of the things we just worked on was just like thinking, you know what I mean? And just like thinking about how things work. Yeah. And I still have some of my graduate school books that I keep looking at every day. Like I'm going to revisit that book. And I never will, right? But they look nice on my shelf. But I just remember taking a class about the principles of computer graphics. And like at the lowest level, you know, what it takes to make a polygon and just like all the ideas and patterns that just have come out of that space. Because somebody said, I want to be able to show 3D objects on the screen. Right. Like that was the idea. Somebody had that idea. So like now people like Ryan Carniato and then you got Alex Rickabaugh and Pablo K from Angular team. They're like, OK, how do we expand signals beyond just like synchronous activity? Right. How do we go even further? And so now they're thinking about these things and, you know, and more patterns are emerging. It's just so fascinating. Like, you know, how computer science continues to live on.
Like on that note, because you just published the resource RFC, we will put the link to that in the show notes as well. And I love the way that you differentiated between the API that you propose and the architectural impact that it has. Because the API is pretty straightforward. People mostly will be like having like nuanced flavors of it, but like we're pretty much accepted. But the architectural impact that's going to have on Angular application. And that's one of the things that I love because like I've been with Angular for like the last 10 years. So I basically did AngularJS, Angular 2, RC, and all the, went through all the phases. And the, it's funny to see how when you joined, like it was a concrete effort to like making the framework approachable. So like if I look at the Angular applications that I've wrote 2016, 2017, they look completely different than the Angular applications that I would write now. And like, I'm pretty sure if we're talking about like 2, 3, 4 years from now with like resources and other things that are in the pipeline, how different that is. So A, I want to thank you for like making the framework more approachable for the broader audience because it still surprisingly has a weird sentiment to it.
Working on
like public presence. I know you're doing great. But the other thing, how do you think? Okay. That's actually the thing that I'm interested in. Like, how do you approach something like that? So like looking at you joined the team, you had like, I assume like some kind of like imposter syndrome, at least that's what I would have joining a team of like standard career, like known for their technical expertise. The framework has been around for years with fantastic folks working on that for years. And you're coming there and be like, I want to make this easier. How do you tackle this?
Yeah, sure. So at least the part that I spent the most time on over the last like 5 years has been like the learning journey, right? Like really doing that, doing lots of talks and just kind of dispelling like rumors and myths and misinformation about Angular, you know? Like people were like, oh, you know, this is it Angular 2 or is it Angular 1? I'm just like, well, we're actually on Angular 15. So your argument isn't even making sense anymore just because it's like such outdated ideas about Angular. So the first thing was a lot of humility and a lot of let me understand how we got where we are and what people care about. So let me break that down a little bit more. How we got where we are. So a part of that was me asking questions like, oh, you know, why do people say that it's so complex? And asking team members, asking community members, so, okay, now I understand about that. And then like, okay, let me understand why we made those decisions. What were we trying to solve? So asking engineers like, okay, what does this do? Because I don't think that this is wrong. So if you think of like zones, which is our way of like being able to tell if something changed, that's people, you know, complain about it. But I started saying it in a different way. I was like, yo, think about this. We made a framework where if you change your data, your state of your application, it'll automatically update everything on the screen. Right? That's like magic. So in other frameworks, you got to use like set state or you got to do a render. You ain't got to do none of that. we made it so that way if you just change the state. But we never explained it that way, right? You see what I'm saying? Like, we never said, but again, you remember I told you in the beginning, I'm thinking about how do you serve your learners, right? So I started thinking about how can you say it in a way that people could understand? I'm like, yeah. So we made it so that way you could just update your state and then everything, you know, magically re-renders. But what we found out is that at scale, it didn't perform as well. And that language is much better than, oh, you know, it's a really bad architectural decision or like Angular is needlessly complicated. Look at the zones and change detection. Those are just artifacts of what we learned. You see what I'm saying? We just learned that it just wasn't good at scale. So anyway, so you got those 2 points. And then the last part was slowly but surely gaining my own understanding of the complicated things and then thinking about how to recommunicate those things out and then pushing back on the team like, all right, this does not feel good. You know, like this design decision, I don't think this is good for our users. I just don't. What else can we do? What else can happen? What are the options available to us? So doing a lot of that mix over time is how you kind of get to where we are now, where people are like at least willing to acknowledge that we have improved. They're not necessarily all willing to acknowledge that we're good, which I think we're very good. But people are at least willing to acknowledge like, oh yeah, Angular is better than it used to be.
One thing that I think the Angular team particularly excels at, and that loops back to my earlier point, I think you made great improvements in terms of transparency around what you're working on, what's on the roadmap. And that's one thing that I as a developer appreciate so much because I know, okay, this is where the ship is heading and I can mentally prepare for that. Like in the resource RFC, for instance, I saw someone saying, well, I implemented a resource myself and now I have to like think about migrating it, which is fair and like kind of painful. But like you do everything to prepare for like this level of transparency that people don't have to reinvent mm-hmm. the wheel if they don't want to. And that's things, I mean, like in my position as advocate, I like look at all the frameworks and stuff that I miss sometimes at the other, in the other ecosystems, like that level of transparency, what's going on.
And a lot of credit to our leadership on that, you know, of getting the RFCs there, continuing to just like work more in public. One of the things that Jeremy Elborn and I do, which is our live stream where we just talk. We used to play video games and then people complained all the time about how we should be working. I'm like, we are working, but we're also talking to you all. And so like now we like sometimes we'll write code or we'll show off new APIs and we'll just talk about the rationale. I do agree that like that level of transparency, but a lot of that was decisions by the leadership to be like, yeah, we're going to do more RFCs. We're going to publish our roadmap. We're going to maintain the roadmap. We're going to talk about it.
Yeah, I'm very glad that these leadership pushes, can you say, have been done. That's, I think, really good for the framework. And I personally appreciate that a lot. So, okay, I mean, everyone, you're kind of like the public face of Angular right now. So you can just take it. I know you're very humble. Sure. So, but what is a project that is very meaningful to you that people may not know about?
Mm-hmm. Great one. You know, a project that's always going to have a big part of my heart is just, well, but people know about this, but I think the learning journey will always have a big part of my heart just because I just want people to be able to like have a good time learning. But I think that incremental hydration, defer, and just our server story, like I think people kind of have an idea about these things, but I think that is like, man, when I first saw defer internally, when we first started demoing it, I was like, there's no way. Like, why are we not on every street corner of the tech space talking about this magical feature from the future where you could, at the template level, lazy load things based on like customizable triggers? Like, when you, where else can you do that? Like, people are like, oh, we got islands. I'm like, you sure do have islands. But do you have an island that you can click a button that will dynamically load that component? And it's only like 3 lines of code and you're not at the router. You're not at your like configuration. I'm like, that is like magic. And now that we have like incremental hydration, which I think more people should think about, that you could partially hydrate your application. Like, wait, what? Like, we don't have to do the full thing. We can just pick the parts that we care about. So when you think about those types of features, I'm just like, how are we just not like only talking about this? You know what I mean? Like, why isn't everybody talking about this? But those are some features that I think are just really from the future.
Yeah. And you did so well in the announcement of it with Jessica's talk at ngConf last year. It was like the perfect demo, like showcasing this like concept that is particular for Angular developers or which are not used to like the server mm-hmm. story before was like so great in like the way it was visualized, the way it was presented. Like everyone was just like, yeah, this totally makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was great. And I love that you're pushing that narrative now, a lot because it is very innovative. Mm-hmm. So
totally agree. Totally agree. Very innovative. And hopefully what we'll see is the industry adopt these types of patterns and these new innovations and everybody benefits, right? Like we aren't the creator of signals.
Yeah.
Right. And neither is Ryan Carniato, right? But like he popularized it with Solid. And it's a really good idea. And I think that one thing on the Angular team that I think we really benefit from is our humility around a good idea is a good idea, whether we created it or not. And I think that we have really good leadership on our team and our tech leads are just like, yeah, no, this is a good pattern. We should implement this. Like we didn't create hydration, but it's a good idea.
Yeah.
Right. So we should like leverage good ideas.
How do you stay on track of those great ideas happening in the ecosystem? Is it just like it happens organically because you folks happen to talk to each other regularly? Or because, I mean, I assume to some extent you're like busy shipping at the end of the day, right? Like you have roadmaps and stuff you need to deliver to some extent. I'm pretty sure Google wants you to work on certain features and those kind of things. So how do you make sure and integrate this level of like innovation?
Sure. Well, one thing I love about this team, and Angular team is probably the best team I've ever worked on. We are very curious, just as a team. We're just very curious. And so sometimes the tech leads will be like, hey, have you seen this really cool thing? Not like, oh, have you seen this? We have to rip it off ourselves. It's more like, hey, look at what they're doing over here. Isn't this cool? And we're just like, yeah, that is pretty rad. Like, oh, that's really cool. For example, Jeremy Elborn is a very public like fan of Svelte, you know what I mean? And he's like, yeah, they just have some really great like ergonomics, developer experience. And we all just stay curious and like see what people are doing. And it's like, then you take that idea. So we try to keep track by staying curious. Then we say, okay, will this serve our users, right? Not everything that's out there is for Angular developers or will benefit Angular developers.
Yes.
Right. So we have to be sure to look at what the needs are, what the priorities are, and then see, like, does this solve a pain point for Angular users? And so, like, Signals is continuing to solve a major pain point of, like, just state and data management in Angular, and eventually reactivity and fine-grained reactivity is where we're headed toward, right? And, you know, that's our, like, goalpost. It's like, okay, how do you now only update a part of the or re-render a part of the screen where that piece of data updated but leave the other part alone? Right. Like that's our goalpost.
Yeah.
But Signals helps us get really close to that idea.
Yeah. So, but like outside of the Angular space, is there a passion project?
Oh,
maybe even unrelated to tech.
Oh, sure. Okay. So outside of the Angular space, yeah, I have a lot of passion projects. I want to say this, and it's probably going to come back to bite me someday, but I've always wanted to be a fitness influencer. I wanted that long before I like joined Google and, you know, I used to do competitive, natural bodybuilding. So like, meaning like no performance enhancing, like supplements, right? So everything had to be like natural.
Yeah.
And so I used to do these competitions and stuff. And, I used to have to sneak my camera into the gym because it was so taboo to like put your camera.
Oh,
oh my gosh. In the 2010s and 2007, I think I did my last competition in 2013. So I worked out, you know, whatever. But yeah, so I would like hide my camera on like the back of like one of the machines just to get like a 10-second clip. And we had so much, it was like a different culture as well, because it was really embarrassing to get caught filming yourself. Where now the culture is like, yeah, I set up a tripod and I set up lights and I like stand in the gym. Back then it was like, you got a camera in here? What are you doing with that camera in here, bro? Like, why is your phone out? Well, your phone would get like potato video. So it wouldn't even be like good video. So you had to have like a little camera. So like now I'm really like, I don't know. That's a passion project of like filming my like health journey now that I'm older. I'm in my mid 40s now. And I'm just trying to think about like, oh, who can I help? You know, are there any other guys in their mid 40s, even people in their mid 40s who could like benefit from like some of the things that I'm learning?
Did you notice like your metabolism change or something with like going into the 40s? Because like, I mean, you put that out a while ago where you're like, what would you think how old I am? And I always thought you're like in your early 30s. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm going to say don't get older. No, I want you to get older because that means you're still alive. But here's what you have to come to terms with just as a person. Okay. Yeah. Come to terms with as a person. When you cross, and especially into your 40s, those extra cookies that you eat, they're going to show up right on that midsection, you know, around your face starts getting fuller, your body starts getting fluffier, all the extra cookies, the extra french fries. And then other things just kind of happen, right? Like, you are more susceptible to like long-term effects of poor dieting. So like your blood pressure goes up, blood sugar goes up. Then you start getting to like scary territory, right? Where you're worried about like strokes and heart attacks and diabetes. So all these things are like super important to manage early on. And if I can go back and tell my 30-year-old self something, I would say, hey, listen, buddy, your resilience to your poor dieting, you know, like your junk food habits is going to change over time. And by the time you get into your 40s, it'll be much harder to like make those physical changes to get back to like, you know, like 10% body fat, for example. Like it'd be much harder. And you'll have more things to do, right? Like now my job is more demanding, my family's more demanding, sleep is more demanding. You know what I mean? Like life changes.
Very much. Yeah. And I personally noticed that I also feel much better when I eat clean for like a little bit. Like I love working out. Like I try to incorporate as much as possible. But eating clean doesn't take much more time if you plan for it. Whereas like working out, you need to allocate like an hour or something. If you go to a gym, it might be even more with everything. But like eating healthy doesn't take necessarily more time as long as you
plan. No, if you plan it right, and that's for me has always been the trick. It's like a meal plan of like, okay, this is what I'm going to eat. I already know what I'm going to eat. That really helps.
Oh,
you go ahead. Go, please.
Yeah, sorry. Well, I just said like, I'm going to eat like a trash pan, literally. Like yesterday I was like craving something. I didn't have food around, so I ate like ice cream. Whereas when I have food around, I'm like, okay, you should eat this first.
That's right. That's right. No, what I was going to say is, and another passion project of mine. So like my three areas of like hobbies are like fitness, you know, and like gym stuff. I play guitar. Yeah. And then I like doing video stuff. Those are my like three big areas that I like my passion projects outside of like technical work.
Interesting question. So do you think that your passion project, do you try to incorporate them in your work? Like, I mean, video stuff, for instance, like certainly helps you as developer advocate these days. But do you try to incorporate that or is that just happen to?
Good question. I get lots of practice with video. Well, my video hobby because of my job, right? So if I have to film and just learning about cameras and stuff, that's really interesting. I try to incorporate music when I can. Like back when I first hit the scene in the Angular space, I did this like musical talk where I did like 5 raps.
Right.
that was so much work. The editing was horrible just because it was like I was writing new music, editing, and filming. And I remember the conference organizer was like, we need your talk. We need the video of your talk. And I'm like, I promise you, if you just give me a couple more days, it'll be ready and it'll be so worth it. And when I finally delivered that was a lot of fun. But like when I did that keynote last year, my last keynote at that conference, I played guitar on stage as a way to just kind of like continue to try to integrate the things that I care about in more spaces of my life whenever I can.
Oh. Yeah, I notice like I try to separate them as much as possible. Like I do enjoy like the video work and it keeps me curious and learn about it, but I feel like when I like the same way I would not want to like professionally just do videos, all this stuff, because I would easily get burned out on those things, and then like out of the passion project it would become a burden for me. So I'll try to separate work and those kind of things as much as possible. Which is just a thing that I noticed, because otherwise I would probably work 24 hours.
Yeah, but the thing about like video and photography that I love the most, I'll tell you my thing. I like taking my camera places and taking pictures of strangers and then sending them like this high quality photo, like right on the spot. Right. So I'll like transfer it to my phone and I'll like airdrop it. And like, man, I just love, I'm going to tell you, Jan Eagles, like it is like this. delight that you get to like offer this gift to somebody. So, cause like you'll see people like trying to take a selfie and they get their like phone and you know it's going to be a bad picture. Like, you know, the picture's going to suck.
Yeah.
And it's just like, man, okay, I have my like nice camera, my like, you know, beautiful lens. I'm like, you know what, can I take this picture for you and then just send it to you? And they're like, wait, what? I'm like, yeah, I'm just going to send it to you. I'm not going to post it on my Instagram. I just want the practice of taking pictures. I want to see if I can get you a nice photo. And I do that quite often. And, it always is always special. And the moment for them is always special when they get this like beautiful photo. And then they're like, man, I can't believe you did that for me. Thank you so much. You know, so it's a great moment.
Yeah. The pictures you made of my talk last year at NG Company.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
So,
yeah.
Thank you very much. Yeah. And I can totally relate to that because, like, I mean, you know it, this podcast is called The Weekly Dev Brew. So I have like a coffee addiction, someone would say. So I just love making coffee for people. And most of them are like, I just drink a cup a day, or like, I usually just grab one at like Starbucks or something. I don't care. But when you give them like a properly brewed coffee and they're like, oh yeah, okay, this is better. Even if they don't like, can like fully figure out and like why it's different and how it's better and like why I like to spend so much time with it. But like the delight in their eyes when they're like, oh yeah, okay, I see what you're saying. I don't want to spend like all that time and learn those things, but I see what you're saying. It brings me.
Oh, that's exactly right. So that like making someone a cup of coffee, like they can have their own coffee, but you get to like, you know, like live in it's like a moment of service. I'm telling you, that word service is like such a core value of mine, but it's like, you're serving somebody, like you're using your gifts to serve somebody else. And then I use my passion for coffee or for hot brewed drinks and like make you this like beautiful coffee and you just get to have this like special moment. See, this is exactly what I mean. Like, this is like, imagine taking that type of attitude toward like your work. Like, how can I be in service of the people around me, in service of our customers, in service of like, you know, the leadership? Like, how can I create those experiences? And I think it's something special that can come out of that.
I have one last question for you. Because I had this conversation the other day with a friend of mine, and we were talking about like, okay, is AI going to take our job? Yes, it doesn't really matter what the result of that is. But are you mentally preparing for the fact, okay, tech might not look the way it does right now in 10 years. Is there something that I can do in case my tech job might be in danger at some point? And what would that be for
you? Good question. I think about this all the time about like how tech is going to change due to AI. Like, as the models get better and better, like everybody's releasing great models and now you can't really make a bad choice. Right. So now it's just like, all right, with that being said, you know, what can, you know, do I think my job is going away? I don't think my job is going away. I think tech jobs will change. But I think what will be interesting is your ability, again, to like know architecture, design patterns and everything like that. Like, I think all that's still going to matter. And the reason I say that is because, you know, when a design pattern goes back to what I said in the beginning of like knowing what to do is going to be so important, right? Versus like writing a prompt. I mean, writing a prompt is super cool, but you got to know what needs to go in the prompt. Right. But you got to be able to like guide the conversation. So imagine you being able to be like, all right, I have this other person who can do anything that I want them to do, but I got to tell them what to do. Right. So that's what an AI coding assistant becomes at the end of the day. Right. Like, it's a developer who can do anything you want them to do for the most part, but you have to know what needs to be done to get the right output.
Yeah.
And so the same way we had to learn how to write, remember when Google searching was a skill and we had to learn how to like write good Google searches to find what you want. And now we've evolved the algorithm to be so good that we kind of know what you mean. But AI is at that era now where your prompting has to be good, but the prompt is only informed by your technical knowledge. You see, so it's not like, oh, the prompt is magic. You are still the magic. Right. Like, as an engineer, like all that work you've put in, Jan Niklas, for the last, you know, 10 plus years at Angular, when you ask, you know, Project IDX, for example, to like generate a component or to make some code, you know what needs to go into that component. That way you're not wasting time having to reprompt and reprompt and spending days reprompting. It's like, no, I know what I need. Right. And then you can like get it to do it and then you can fill in the gap. So I'm thinking about, how do I work like that? I think also the thing that people are totally skipping beyond is, what are the new design patterns of AI-powered apps? what is the architect? What is the architecture? What is the deployment story? What, you know what I mean? What is all of this? So like having AI help you with your work is one story, but then having AI as a part of your work, like, okay, I'm building an app that has AI in it. Like, how do I do that? Like, what is the right, you know, pattern for that? How do I minimize cost? Like per token, like how do I like, you know, make my embeddings really good? Like there's still so much to learn and so much to benefit from that it's just a new frontier, right? That we're going to be working on. We're not working on mainframes anymore. We're working at an even higher level of extraction.
That's very true. But in case tech goes to shit, just hypothetically, I hope not because I built a career on top of this, but in case that happens, what is your
fallback plan? What did I just tell you? I told you that already. I'm going to be a fitness influencer. I'm just being like...
Okay, I yeah, you did.
No. I'm just being silly. No, I was being silly. I didn't... No, but in reality, though, I really am thinking like, okay, for me, luckily, I'm a performer, right? Like, I can perform on camera, perform on stage. And so I'll probably do something in the performing area. I'll see where if there's still teach. I love to teach. So teaching could be something, but I probably would like... Yeah, but I don't know what the what AI education will be in 10 years, right? That may be something
I'm curious
huge.
To see that.
So that's something interesting to me. I also thought about this. I've been remodeling my home myself. So maybe I become a contractor, right? Or like a carpenter and just do that type of stuff.
It's not going to be replaced by AI, very likely. At least I don't see how. And woodworking is fun. Dangerous. I still have all my fingers.
Yeah, a lot of fun. Yeah, I just replaced the toilet. I replaced the sink. I remodeled my entire home gym down to like ripping up carpet, laying down a new floor, doing baseboards, painting, installing wall-mounted equipment. I mean, like I did a lot of stuff. And so this just, because I think of it like an engineer, like it's problems to solve, right? And you got these variables. So maybe I become a carpenter. Or here's the dream. Maybe I'll just figure out like, I'll make a good lucky investment in something like maybe my YouTube channel, maybe, you know, something just pays off and then I get a couple of million. And then I'm just like, look, I'll go work at Trader Joe's or Whole Foods, right? Like I'll just go be a cashier because I don't need the money.
Yeah, I honestly, like I would probably love to work in a coffee shop like and just but like from a financial aspect. It just doesn't make
sense. So you need the same thing as I need. We need our media careers to blow up so that way we can have, you know, a few million and then we can go do jobs that we just want to do for fun that don't, you know what I mean, that we don't care about the pay.
I do have to say, though, like working in tech is a thing that I very enjoy. So I already feel pretty lucky of like having a job that I like doing. And it happens also to be financially reliable and everything. So...
I totally agree with that. Agree. That's a really good grounding thing to remember. Yeah. Like I said, I love my job. I love my team. You know what I mean? Like, here's another thing that I'll probably do. Maybe I should go be an actor. I've been hosting that show, Elite Heat.
That's so good.
I like being on stage. Like, you know what I mean? Like, we're on camera, like on set. Like, that was amazing. That was an amazing experience. Shout out to Jason Lansdorf and Co. TV.
Yeah, great team, great product. I love what they're doing over there. So yeah, absolutely. I'll put the link in the show note as well. That's great. Check it out. Thank you so much for being on here. This was great. I very much enjoyed this and I always love talking to you.
Feeling is mutual. Thank you for having me.
Anytime. All right. And everyone out there, have a good one. Bye.